Well, Simon, you flew from London to DC to talk about 1033, but we're going to blow that all up and not talk about it because we've got something a lot more exciting to talk about today. So what's that?
I am way more excited by Stripe making their biggest acquisition ever, a company called Bridge for $1.1 billion. That is the largest Stripe acquisition ever. That is the largest crypto acquisition ever. And I think it's crypto's mainstream moment, but let's discuss.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, two key questions we're going to unpack here. One is this Stripe's Instagram moment, right? John and Patrick have acquired Bridge. Zuck bought Instagram, WhatsApp. Those transformed the business despite people being like, what are you doing at the time? So that's one, is this their kind of Instagram moment? And two, is this, yeah, the mainstream moment for crypto? So much to unpack there. But let's start with like, what is Bridge? What do they do? And why does Stripe want to acquire them in the first place?
It's a great question. So Bridge provides software that helps businesses accept stablecoin payments, and it simplifies the infrastructure. So they're kind of like Stripe for traditional payment types. And it solves a massive, massive pain point in payments generally, but dealing with stablecoins generally. Like if you've ever tried to use a stablecoin, you have to go get a wallet and then you have to pick a flavor of dollar that you want to use. So let's say I'm trying to send you $10. I'm going to send you USDC or USDP or Tether. I don't know. And then is that compatible with your network? So do I need a different dial code for your network? Am I going to bridge it? Wow. It's the user experience is horrible and it's really, really hard. But the promise of stablecoins is unbelievable. It's global. It's 24/7. It's instant. Global 24/7 and instant is not something true about any other payment type. Every other payment type has office hours. It just closes. Stuff goes wrong. Money doesn't move. It gets stuck. So stablecoins, if you could make them work, would be brilliant. And they'd solve some huge problems. But they're very hard to use. So Stripe moving into that space, they got a lot of merchants. They're trying to expand internationally. Bridge is already doing that for some pretty impressive companies.
Yeah, Bridge, they're working with SpaceX, the US government, and their aid agencies, helping them move money around globally. There are also some interesting, I think, why nows for stablecoins. First stablecoin, I think 2016. We're now in 2024. It used to be kind of expensive to send some stablecoins on chain, but we can show data how the price on chain has collapsed. But to your point, you still have this kind of, you know, many to many problem of swapping between chains, of on ramps, off ramps. That stuff is starting to improve, and so the why now is also like stablecoins are reaching critical volumes. We have some more charts showing how the volumes there are starting to tick up. But to circle this back to the Stripe question, like, is this Stripe's Instagram moment? One of the big questions, Stripe's a great company. They're worth tens of billions of dollars. They're doing, you know, high single digit billions of revenue, like $3.4 billion in net revenue. But if you want to be a really great company, like this thing about Silicon Valley, we're always raising the bar on founders, right? Oh, you know, $100 billion company, that's not good enough. Do you want to be Zuck? Do you want to build a $1 trillion company? And there, what you have to do is, you know, they basically had one product. It's acquiring online. It's not quite true. They have some other stuff. Stripe Billing now does $500 million in revenue, right? But if you want to have like a really big next unlock and you want to show investors how you can grow instead of just they're growing 20% a year, you can continue to grow at least that much or more and have new products over time. You've got to find new markets. And this is what Facebook did with Instagram, with WhatsApp. This is what, you know, Larry and Sergey did with AdSense and YouTube. So like to be a really big company, I don't think people appreciate the extent to which you have to take bold bets about where the future is headed and pay up for it.
And the Instagram moment was about maintaining relevance in a market shift, right? So doing ads was how you monetize. And I think it's the perfect parallel because what Facebook did is figure out ads and then they figured out how to move that to Instagram and to something else. You were just talking about billing. What Stripe has done with billing and that software stack, which as you said, is doing about $500 million in revenue. That's meaningful. It's a unicorn in its own right, you know, on a revenue multiple. They've moved up from payments into the software stack. Like payments are getting commoditized. The price, the fee compression is a race to the bottom. unless you can go solve all of these jobs to be done above payments. And that's what, like, tourists to the industry don't get, is all the pain is around moving the money. Moving the money on like the simplest basis is a commodity, but it's all the things that go wrong that you have to deal with in your business. So billing plays there. But the problem also with payments is this whole other side is like there's a whole audience you're missing. Stripe is not Stripe in South Korea. Stripe is not Stripe in Nigeria. There are massive.
They had to buy PayStack. That was their other big acquisition, $200 million, which is basically the Stripe for Africa.
And so they've had to do these things to try and get access. But payments just has this endless last mile problem in that you can't get to that last mile unless you have something else. So I thought it was super interesting that Patrick Collinson, I'll get my Collinsons right, said stablecoins are room temperature superconductors for financial services. Businesses around the world will benefit from speed, coverage, and cost improvements in the coming years. And I think that coverage and speed thing, like that means that if I run like a Shopify store anywhere in the world, I get paid instantly. And it means I can be anywhere in the world because, you know, payments are just don't work like that right now. And it's the way the world's going. Look at where the growth's coming from. The IMF just put out their report saying, you know, the advanced economies are growing at like 1% and the emerging ones, Nigeria, India, that's where the growth is coming. How do I play there? I play there with stablecoins.
Yes. And you said, you know, Stripe wants to be the software layer on top of payments. Their first product was taking payments and bringing them online. But the payment platform they built on top of, and they still are on top of today, it's the same payment platform that everyone else is using, all their competitors are on top of, and enterprise payments is very competitive, very low margin. It's a hard business. So if you want to carve out a stake for yourself in the future, when you see a potential platform shift, like we're still in the early innings of stable, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on, but it's still early, which is why this is something people are talking about. It's like, oh, that's a big price for something we haven't seen other people doing big moves in. Like, we want to own the next platform so we can be the layer on top of that platform. Just like Zuck said, look, Instagram, WhatsApp, these are going to be big ways in which people interact socially. We need to be at the forefront of that.
Oh, completely. And how do you get there? Well, you've got to time it perfectly. Stablecoins 3-4 years ago, you could have said, oh, is there regulatory clarity? Well, you have banks in Europe issuing stablecoins now. Societe Generale has issued a stablecoin. You have that now increasingly sort of under the MiCA regulation. You also have this different world with the likes of Paxos and Circle doing meaningful work to be regulated and audited. There's always that question about Tether, but, you know, sort of 3-4 years ago, stablecoins meant Libra, and, you know, central bankers hated the idea of Libra, and it meant Terra Luna, and it meant, you know, like this algorithmic stablecoin and things that implode, that stablecoins weren't stable. Well, there are some that are remarkably stable. If you go look at the charts over the last 5 years, USDC, Tether, they've all held their peg to the dollar pretty much perfectly. So I think some of those myths have gone.
Yeah, so I think we've answered the question of like why Stripe is interested in a platform shift. And now I think what we're starting to get into is that question of, is this a platform shift, right? And what you're saying is you can see it in the volumes, you can see it in the transaction costs, you can see it in the market awareness of players like Stripe. I also just want to touch on a first principles perspective of why I think stablecoins start from a better fundamental place than our banking system. And I think this is probably going to rub some people the wrong way, and that's fine. But if you think about our banking system, the way it is set up is you take money, you put it in a black box, and the bank, honestly, you have no idea what the bank is doing with that money. They could be placing weird derivative trades. They could be making bad loans. They could be embezzling funds. They could be engaged in fraudulent activities. Most of them aren't, but they can do that. And you actually don't have any clarity as to exactly how that's doing. And you might say, that's crazy. Banks are safe. Like, I definitely trust banks. To which I would show you a list of banking crises that we have had. And it's over 200 years, like all the time. Because there is something fundamental about that maturity transformation that creates risk. Right, so banking is risky, and then banking is coupled to our payment system. So what is a stablecoin? A stablecoin, the good ones, are a box that you put money into, and then they take that money and they put it into treasuries. Now, to your point, some of them They literally do that, and they get audited financial statements that say, yes, we are 1-1 backed by treasuries. Treasuries are the largest, most liquid asset in the world. That is fundamentally a safer construct for how you can store money, just store money, than putting it into the black box that is the banking system that has historically been prone by tons of crises. But stablecoins are also connected to a new kind of more internet-native ledger that allows payment capabilities to move money very quickly. So if you listen to that, you'd be like, oh my God, Rex is like crazy bullish on stablecoins. And I am, like, I'm excited about it because I think from first principles, it is a better way of storing money. And it also is a new, cheaper way of moving money. There is a big thing, which is one, some aren't audited, like, you know, the Tethers and other stuff in the world. And that could be problematic, especially if it creates regulatory backlash against the good players. And then two, just because you can move money within a stablecoin ecosystem, well, now you have to do the between the stablecoin ecosystem, and that's where Bridge comes in, right? And then you also have to do all the on-ramps and the off-ramps to the rest of the financial ecosystem. And that is why, even though from first principles, I think we're in an interesting spot, we're seeing the volumes go up, we're seeing the pricing come down, we're seeing the pipes being built, we are still so early, is because that is so much work to do.
It's unbelievable work to do. And I think neither Bridge nor my good friend Kai Sheffield over at Visa nor the guys at Stripe are blind to that, which is why the Instagram acquisition is a 10-year bet, not a 1-year bet. The 1-year bet for Stripe is all about, you know, the software layer. It's about billing. It's about doubling down on that. And that's where they see growth coming from. This is building for the future and knowing that that's going to be a long, long game. But let's just compare it versus Swift and the other types of international money movement today, right? So I can move money with Swift, and the benefits of Swift are that, look, my bank's doing it. It's going to get checked for all of the fraud rules and anti-money laundering rules. It's going to officially appear to everybody involved as a cross-border transaction, but that's often manual and costly. So your bank will charge you anywhere between $30 and $100 to do exactly that, because that's really, really hard. The cost isn't in the rail, it's in all of the checks that happen around it, right? Then the alternative is like Wise or Revolut.
And it's going to hit several correspondent banks along the way. So when you send money to someone and you're like, where's the money? Literally no one can answer that question for you. Right?
So for example, if I'm sending money from HSBC to the United States, but you want it to go to your smaller bank, then it might go to Chase, who then sends it on to the smaller bank, but that might have a 3-day clearing period. So it takes a period of time. So this first hop of Swift might have even been instant between the big banks, but you're slow as the slowest mover on the network. The alternative to that is companies like Revolut and Wise, who connect lots of local payments networks, but they also store money locally so that Simon thinks he's paying Rex and Rex thinks he's getting paid by Simon. But what's happening is another person in the US is getting paid by Rex and is, you know, kind of moving money to Rex and vice versa. Simon's getting paid. Netting. That's what really happens. And then they use stuff like ACH, lower cost rails like FedNow and faster payments to actually settle that. The problem with that is it looks like a local payment to most of the people involved. And that's where a lot of the sanctions abuse and anti-money laundering comes along. Stablecoins fix this. Stablecoins look like a US dollar movement until somebody tries to spend it in local currency, and then it looks like a cross-border transaction. So that is the regulatory argument I'm having in DC quite a lot, which is to say, actually, this could be quite good. And there's a lot of arguments against this stuff that the cynics would bring up.
Yeah, so one argument would be like, oh, you put your money in a stablecoin, you lose all your money. I think if you have audited financial statements, you're 100% backed by treasuries. That's not a good argument. Another argument would be like no fraud, KYC. Well, not fraud, but so much as KYC and AML controls. Fraud more hit the providers, which they don't want, versus, you know, society not wanting AML issues. You can still solve for that with, you know, having the same set of things. But yeah, I think there's this huge opportunity for all this stuff. And also, if you talk to Zach or you talk to Patrick and John at Stripe, they will tell you, like Zach will tell you pretty straightforward, like, yeah, I have a lot more stuff to build. Like, it's not like this is fait accompli. Yeah, it's a $1 billion acquisition. It's 90x revenue. So like top line revenue is $12 million. But this is just an indication of a potentially large platform shift that Stripe needs to be in front of. Let's do some other myth busting. So Simon, myth number one, Trump.
Myth number one I hear is that this is just a cynical bet on Trump winning an election. I don't think it's that. The reason I don't think it's that is because there are too many other companies I speak to in payments meaningfully investing in stablecoins as a route to goal for them at the most senior level. So the market view I have says that's simply not true. Myth number two is the idea that it's 90% bots, therefore it's not useful. Well, the US dollar has a lot of high frequency trading by bots. And if you look at the notional value of dollars traded, most of it moves in capital markets in notional value on a day-to-day basis. There aren't a lot of transactions, but there's a lot of money moving in notional value versus payments, where there's way more transactions, but way less value in them. There's a really good chart by Andreessen that compares all of the different payment rails like Fedwire versus ACH versus Visa versus PayPal versus stablecoins. And the interesting thing about stablecoins is they both have a lot of transaction value and a lot of transaction volume. That's rare. So about 10% of the volume really is peer-to-peer transactions, it's payouts, it's that sort of thing. And there's at least $100 million US to Mexico already happening to another chart I found, which we can show here. So this is like really meaningful volume. It's not Wise or Revolut just yet, but it's the early signs of something that could be working. So cynics, go look at the data.
Any other myths you want to bust about stablecoins?
I think that just it's not regulated thing. You know, the United States is still trying to figure out how it wants to regulate things. I suspect after an election, whoever gets elected, then we're going to get a rule passed. We got very close to legislation that would deal with how you custody stablecoins. It's going to look like Mika. It's good if you want to sort of look at that. And again, I've been in DC with a lot of the technical staff. I suspect that will start to play out. So that it's not regulated is just gone. I think that's the other big one.
I think I have a myth I want to bust for our American audience. And this is really to your myth. Stablecoins aren't useful. And I will say, if you are an American, what you may not realize is that you get to use the world's best currency and you don't even have to think about it. That is not true for most of the world. A lot of the world, and John Collison says this in a recent Money Stuff podcast, has an adverse relationship with their currencies. And that's not just, you know, hyperinflation states like Zimbabwe or high inflation states like Argentina. It can even be other places too, where inflation is still an issue, or you just have high cross-border volume and trade. So the ability to transact on top of the US dollar is a key feature of stablecoins that is underappreciated by people who live in the US. And on top of that, I would also add, in terms of things that allow for the acceleration of adoption, if you look globally, not only do they not have access to the US dollar, but they also often are more greenfield markets where they haven't built as much of the financial infrastructure we have. We have built a lot of it, but it's kind of ossified, but it's still hard to change. Whereas in other places, you can just leapfrog. And then they also have more accommodative regulatory regimes. So if you have what is a better product for people abroad in a greenfield market with a more accommodative regulatory regime, a lot can be happening in stablecoins that you as an American will not see.
I think people confuse it's not useful to me right now with it's not useful, and those are not the same thing at all. Yet we talk a lot about PIX, we talk a lot about UPI, we get that, but we don't use them day to day, and yet we're excited by them. And I think there's a default cynicism to crypto, which is not unwarranted. I was listening to John Connerton on the Money Stuff podcast, and he had the perfect metaphor for crypto in general. He said, think about it like Money 2020. In order to get to the serious bit of payments conference, you have to walk through the smokers and the casinos and the blinking lights, and it's kind of gnarly and not always great. And then there's a serious bit of business happening over here in the corner with this serious industry conference. And that sort of dichotomy is exactly true in crypto. There is this ugly scam, tax, fraud side that's true. Most people in crypto hate crypto for that reason. But then there's also this other thing over here, and both of those things are true, and that's really, really hard to hold in mind, especially if you're not getting value out of this thing day to day. Like, how's it useful to me right now? It's not. Therefore, it's irrelevant. It's not true.
Yeah. And I think another criticism will be like, aren't they, and this is a Matt Levinism from Money and Stuff, say that, you know, crypto people are discovering, sometimes embarrassingly in public, why we've built things in the financial system a certain way, and they're kind of reinventing it on top of a new platform. And so the criticism is like, nothing to see here. They're just like rebuilding what we already have. And it's like, that is correct, only they're doing it on a new, more kind of internet native architecture that allows you to move past a lot of the ossification we've had in how our payment system works. For example, if you had to build a payment system from day one, do you want, you know, Fedwire, which is controlled by the Fed, which is basically controlled by the banks for the privilege of the banks, not necessarily just for the benefit of the consumers? Do you want ACH, which is also kind of controlled by the bank? Do you want Visa and MasterCard, which are a duopoly and control? Like, they're all of these payment rails. And so we need things that allow us to get around people who have a chokehold on our existing infrastructure.
If you study the history of D. Hawk, the founder of Visa, if you look at his first principles vision for what that network was originally supposed to be, the chaotic organization, it was supposed to be as global as possible, default global, and it was supposed to be default instant and default digital. The reality is most payment systems aren't digital, they're digitized. ACH's automated check clearinghouse. Like, this is designed around the paper process that we had and clearing them. It's an evolution. You haven't sat back and looked at it from first principles, how you design it now that you have the internet thing. It would look a little bit more like a stablecoin. However, stablecoins don't remove all of the first principles of risk. They don't remove all of the first principles of identity issues. So those are all still true. So of course you have to add a lot of those lessons back in, just as you add them back into any technology revolution. So there's value in both of those arguments. I want to just close on a thought here that, like, there's a concept that happened after World War II called the Eurodollar. So during the Marshall Plan, there were a lot of banks in Europe, as Europe was being rebuilt by the Marshall Plan, by the USA, that were receiving dollars.
Yep. They just, and it's basically the US pushing money into Europe because Europe needs to rebuild post.
And so these dollars that were offshore held at banks became known as the Eurodollar. And so whenever you have offshore dollars at a bank, you call it a Eurodollar. And the Eurodollar market became very well known. And initially, the US didn't really like it. It wasn't very well controlled. It was a bit weird.
I'm glad you brought this up. Yeah.
And then what happened is some bank in the UK went, you know what? Our interest rate in the UK is higher than in the US. In the US, you have a regulation that caps your interest. Why don't you store your dollars with us and we'll give you a higher interest? So it was like this little arbitrage that was happening, but it was sort of done between friends and nobody paid attention. And then they did. And, you know, again, the regulators made some, we don't really like that sort of noises, but it just sort of happened. Fast forward to the 1970s, and the US dollar is the global trading currency for oil, the petrodollar, as we get off Bretton Woods and the gold standard. Bang. The Eurodollar is the default offshore dollar, and it's now very, very common to be holding dollars, and that's how you become the global reserve currency. A way to think about stablecoins is a US dollar for non-bank entities. I can hold a stablecoin like in a self-custodial wallet, just like holding a US dollar physical note, and I can walk around any country in the world with that US dollar, and somebody's probably going to accept it. This is the digital version of that, but it works for businesses as well. So they can sort of settle between each other, settle instantly with this narrow banking structure underneath it. And that, as a first principles thought, is extremely powerful.
Yeah, and that's powerful for understanding why US dollar access for non-Americans is very valuable. But I also want to call out why having non-Americans be able to use the US dollar banking system is incredibly good for America. Right? Like, so one, we're the reserve currency of the world. We want to continue to be the reserve currency of the world. Our number one government expenditure is interest on the national debt. It's like $3,000 per person per year. If more people hold dollars, it drives down our borrowing costs. That is a good thing. We spend way too much. That's a separate question around, you know, fiscal issues, but lowering borrowing costs is a good thing for us. Two, it gives us tremendous control over how the world's economy works if we are the reserve currency that everyone else is building on top of. And if we push stablecoins away from us, they will grow up globally. And it's just a question of the extent to which we have a controlling seat at the table. And I feel like big power politics are kind of back on the table in and around lots of different geopolitical issues. And so we want to make sure that the US dollar remains the world's preeminent currencies. And stablecoins have just fallen in our lap. Let's not screw that up.
Well, so do you know the 18th largest holder of US debt is Tether? And that is enabling this sort of new payments mechanism. They will very quickly shoot up the ranks as countries like China and India and others are looking to sell their US dollar exposure, as Russia and others are looking to move away, as the BRICS currency is coming along. What you want is the most competitive, easy to use, developer-friendly currency in the world that becomes just much more usable, because that is not compatible with how the Chinese think about controlling their currency. It's not compatible with how even the Indian system works, because you know they want to export UPI, phenomenal success, phenomenally capable system. But you have to use the Indian version of UPI rather than this sort of like gray area euro dollar thing that isn't fully controlled, but is held by, but has some element of control over. That's a great place to be. You become the global payments market.
Yeah, let's wrap this up. I think like this is why you have to follow what's going on here with stablecoins generally, as well as with BRICS. One, it's like, is Stripe going to be a $1 trillion company? Well, they need to have new blockbuster things built on top of platform shifts. And this is a potential Instagram type moment for them. Two, this is potentially just a huge payment shift. Again, we're so early. I don't want to oversell like the fact that, you know, we're like, you know, 3% of the way there. And then three, I think there's just a story about America's role in the global financial system that's tied into this. I don't know if there's anything else you think to kind of sum it up for people.
Nothing really other to add other than we talk about this a lot on the Tokenized podcast. It's a subject that I've been following for a decade. The payments industry moves in 7-year increments. Don't expect this tomorrow, but don't ignore it either, because banks are now doing this in Europe, and very soon banks will be looking to do it in the US as well. This is not going away. It's only going to happen more and more. And if your default position is wasn't that sort of Terra Luna, wasn't that explosive, you need a Bayesian update. Come have another look. And then if you still disagree, you disagree. But come have another look.
Awesome. Well, super fun conversation. Sorry we blew up your trip to Washington about Dodd-Frank and 1033. I should also mention, next time you should just come to San Francisco, because sitting right on the other side of this wall, actually, is Zach Abrams from Bridge. Yeah, his office is literally right next to mine. So San Francisco, it's a place where the future of fintech finance is built. So if you want to build stuff, I'm very long San Francisco. London's great, too, for some other global stuff, I guess. anyways, Simon, really fun conversation.
London's just lovely. I'll see you in Vegas.
See you in Vegas.